talking is actually a bad person. Well, it started years ago. I was in Maine, pardon me, I'm a little geezer, about 55 years ago in Washington, D.C. And then I was worked in two parishes, did other kinds of jobs, and then I was made the director of vocations for the seminary to be director of all of that. It was difficult years. And then I was called and sent to a parish in the suburbs, again, just in residence. I'd already been at university as the seminarian. And then on Christmas Eve, I was at an office solemn party, and my cardinal, my archbishop, came here and pulled me into a room closet. Where's the light in there? I got a light. And he said, well, I'm moving. I said, the feminist, you just moved me. But I'm moving you again. But he told me where, and my heart sank. Nobody would want to go that dumb into all his problems and finances and all. It was a slum and 5 minutes from the White House, but it was a bad place to be for a new pastor. I said, well, 1 week you want me to go there. He said, you go tomorrow. I said, no, Eminence, it's Christmas. It's Christmas Eve. He said, Merry Christmas, kid. Move it. So I went home, took down the tree, packed the suitcases, and I moved it. Well, anyway, I was there, and I found out on that Christmas day, feeling sorry for myself. You know, we all get this pity punch, you know. And so I went to the church, and I found $48,000 of unpaid bills in a cardboard box for Catherine Soup. I always remember this. And a comic Christmas collection was $800-some. And I said, boy, I had to multiply this bread and fish. So I was sorry for myself. I admit it. I went to the church, and there was no flowers. It was just miserable looking. And I heard someone coughing. And I went down in the rather dark, and it's the night by then. Everybody was going home, actually. And I found a little African-American lady, Mary Jacobs, who was almost 90 years old, half blind. And we got talking, and she said to me, you want to have dinner with me? And of course, I had no food. The place had been stripped, had been vandalized. There was even salt pepper in the record. So I was thinking about a Wendy's a little bit later. And so I said, what are you serving there? She said, I mix a dog food with beans and rice, makes a great meatball salad, and I said, well, how about you eat with me? I'll come next Christmas with you. Well, I locked her in the rectory literally, and said, I'd open it at the door, and I saw walking down the streets and found a small store open that evening, got hot dogs and beans, and I said to myself, you know, well, at least it's food. And then Mary said, why don't you come down here? And suddenly hit me. I said, Mary, I think God sent me here to find you. I know why I'm here now. Well, because of that meeting, the convent, the nuns that moved out, had been off the solemn, built in the 1800s of German for immigrant children. So I turned into a place for homeless women and died of children. Then I started a cookbook, learning how to cook. And I turned the rectory, and then the school was abandoned. So I got someone to help me fix up the basement and some of the rooms. And I started a food program for old people. We're 5 minutes from the White House. We have people eating dog food. Washington, D.C., you know. This is back in Christmas of 1969. But because of that, one day in the 80s, my archbishop said, well, there's a nun coming here. You work with the poor. I want you to meet her. I wanted to come here. I didn't know who the nun was. I'd never heard of her before. And then that Sunday, she showed up, and I thought she was Hare Krishna the way she dressed, you know, with the fucking outfit she had on, and still didn't know about her. And so she's going to the Sunday in the front, we were talking about the poor and different things in India. And all of a sudden, she said to me, well, why don't you get rid of the door? I said, Mother, every morning I make sandwiches and pile them up and saran wrap in the refrigerator. People come all day long for food. But what do you give? I said, sandwiches. I make pretty good soup now. And I said, fruit, cookies, what else? And nothing else to give them. She said, do you risk your heart? And all of a sudden, she turned everything around for me. I suddenly saw the scenes of the guys and women at the door who are, you know, homeless people. Well, do you have a place to go tonight? That coat doesn't look very good. I remember my mother gave me Stephen, when I walked in the cashier, couldn't get away the front door. She said, no more cuts, son, forget it. But people were desperate. Imagine Washington, D.C., one of the richest capitals in the world, 5 minutes by car, you walk over the street to the White House around it, and people living like this. But it changed my life. And then one day, a few months later, she called me. She said, I'll see you Wednesday. Well, so we've been running back and forth and talking on the phone. I realized she was a holy woman. I said, I'm meeting with a saint without a God. And, but I knew nothing but her greatness at that moment. And then she said to me, I'll see you Wednesday. I said, oh, you're coming to Washington. She said, no, you're coming to India. I said, not me. Mother, I can't afford to go to Baltimore. I'm not making money. She said, I wrote you a letter. You're giving me a retreat in Calcutta. I said, I'm not giving her a retreat in Calcutta. She said, yes, she won't put the phone down. I said, the woman's a tyrant. She's crazy. I'm not going to Calcutta, my God. You know, I hadn't even been in New York by that time to visit. So a friend of mine, a lawyer at the State Department, who's come to confess, she said, I told her, I'll pay you away if you have a pray for me and my wife, just newly married. I said, she's a holy woman. I said, but she's crazy. I said, keep going to Calcutta. I said, you go, I'll pay the way as long as you pray for us. So off I go to England, then to New Delhi, and finally to Calcutta. And when I got on the plane, she was waiting in the usual sign. She said, I knew you would come. I said, she's just born something. But I stayed there, and in 2 weeks, I lost 27 pounds. You want a diet? Boil rice, boil carrots, and boil fish and tea, and it'll do it. So that's your diet if you want to lose weight. And I got home, and of course you take no clothes home with you. People are so desperate. I saw people lying in the streets. I mean, there were 15 million people in Calcutta. I think 10 million in the streets. And when she walked in the street with me, people would rush up and touch her feet and go like this and far, the dust stuck with here. Lay your hands upon me. They considered her like Gandhi, the holy woman of India. And I knew all this till I got to India and saw this myself, experienced it. But when she first, it all started, I remember she was born in 1910. That's quite a few years ago. As an Asian girl, she said, I felt the stirrings of my heart when I was a young child. I wanted to do something for God's poor. And then she grew up, you know, in Albania. And so at the age of 18, her father had died. She had an older brother and sister, and her mother's alive. And she went to Ireland to her sister Loretta with the promise, we will send you to India. I always wanted to go to India. And she stayed there, became superior of the school and mentioned that she taught it. I saw her in the school behind this big wall. And in 19, and then when she was, I was 18, with 18. And in 1948, she said, I was on a train. I wasn't well, so sister said, go to the mountains and just relax. And I heard a voice say, take care of my poor children. I heard a snake in the room, I was beginning to be. I heard the voice say 3 times, my children, my poor, like a vision. And out the other window, I saw people, so if the train stopped, they climbed on the roof or begged them to throw anything for me to eat. It was so desperate. So I went to my superiors in the Archbishop of Calcutta, and they thought maybe she had had hallucinations in her super piety. But finally, they let me write to Rome, and the Holy Father gave me permission 2 years later to go out. So she said, I got a stick. She said, put the uniform on that the women, I think it's in Pakistan, where the section of the loose wife of the Virgin Mary in the rosary. And she, and a good Hindu man gave her 2 little rooms in this building he lived in. And she said, I was take a stick and I would teach children drawing in the dirt how to read and write until people finding any blackboards and things, they felt sorry for us. And she said, one day I walked down the street and it was a monsoon in Edmonton, and I saw something moving, you know, like Fratio and the gun. It was a human face. And I dragged him out, he was half eaten by rats. And I put him in the wheelbarrow and took him to my little roof. He said, I was dying like an animal. I die like an angel now. She said, I knew then why God sent me to India. Yeah, to teach the children. In the meantime, to help his people. So she begged the government. Remember, they had this terrible uprising. The Pakistanis and Indians fighting each other, thousands dying. And she walked in the streets for a while. But this girl came to her. The native became Sister Agnes. I became her buddy too. And Agnes said, "Mother taught me in school." And I went to her and said, "I want to work with you with these poor, poor, desperate people." And Mother said to me, "Three things I promise you. You will see indescribable human suffering. You must live the gospel without any compromise. But the third is, I promise your place with God in heaven if you do this." When Agnes was dying, I talked on the phone. She said the third wish will soon be mine. It's coming true. But gradually, there's one nothing. Sister Joseph is still living. There is a group. And this girl says she wants to start helping her. So they came the nucleus of what they call the Missionaries of Charity, approved by King Paul as a community, a religious community. Today there were 4,000 of the sisters in the world. They're all over the world, different places. But the thing about her was this. I remember that after a conference one day, she said to me, "Now come with me." She took me to the House of the Lepers. It was a former pilgrim hall near a Hindu temple. She didn't tell me this, but I found out. When they first opened it, the sisters would take the lepers there. And some of the Hindus said, they're baptizing as Christians before they die. They're trying to be artificial Christians. And they went in to drag her out and stone her to death. And the priest of the temple went in to find her. And he saw her washing this man with terrible leprosy. As he would describe it to friends later. And the tenderness of which she was bathing him and trying to comfort him. He came out and said, "If you do what she does, we'll stone her." And that was the priest they threw out of the temple a few weeks ago, one of her own. Said, "Never touch her that day on." She was the holy woman. She was the great saint like God. And God loved her. Everybody loved Mother. But this place, I remember, had like a big wooden wall, and she went around it. On this side, way down here, with the women, here with the men. And it's like cement, like a shelf comes down a passage, so you can wash the bodies and the water work down, you can clean things better. That was the first place she built up, and now they're all over the world. They're up as Syrians. In 1985, that was the year she opened her place in New York, House of Love, for people with AIDS. I remember a young man came from Vietnam the next year, and he had AIDS. I don't remember the drug, sex. It wasn't a question. The man is dying. They didn't want to talk to me. So I went to the hospital anyway, you know me. And he said, "I don't want to talk to you." I said, "Okay, John, I'll be back." And just smiled. When I went out in the hall, the nurse knew me. She said, "Isn't AIDS terrible?" I said, "What's AIDS? I'm a cancer survivor. I've never heard of AIDS." And she told me, "You touch their tears, their blood, you're doomed." I said, "My God." I went back the next day. He had some army buddies. He was then 32 years old. He had a birthday cake in front of him. And he said, "We can tell." "Well, I guess you want a piece of cake, don't you?" I thought, "Who wants to die, buddy?" But the way he said it, and the priest said, "Oh, John, yes, cut me a piece of cake. I love cake." And these 4 or 5 got shot up, but they all started to hit this cake. When I finished, he said, "Hey guys, get out. I want to talk to the padre." We walked out the room and closed the door. He said, "Would you hear my confession, Father? It's time to get back." And so I went to wait every day until the day he died. He died on Good Friday afternoon. I always remember that. I was with him. But because of that, I called Mother and I told her what was happening. And she said, "Come to New York. I'll meet you there." And she showed me the place. People were AIDS. Nobody wanted it. You know, I found out plenty of stories about it. You know, you've got AIDS, you're dirt, you're trash. God is punishing you, God puts you in hell. That type of, you know, thumbs down on human beings. But Mother said, when you look at someone suffering, you don't say, but all you say is, "What could I do to bring Jesus to give them love and peace?" That's our task. Let God be the judge. You bring his love, they can come alive there the way you're at. And so anyway, I asked Mother and she agreed to come. We had Catholic Charities, I was the president of board directors. And I said, "Why don't we give Mother our building? It reported McCall for the songs, a beautiful piece, not from Catholic University or Notre Street. I said, be perfect. Mother agreed to come. We couldn't get the mayor, it was quite a mayor we had, permission. We need the official documents. For God forgive me, but I said, well, listen, Mayor, let's put this way. The next time you run for office, I'm going to go on TV and talk about you. We got in 24 hours, we got the literal documents we needed. We got a muscle once on these people in politics. But anyway, Mother came and opened it. It's 25 years ago now. And I remember the first guy that came in, he was had been a former young guy in the Air Force, was a pilot. And his mother was there, but nobody else. And he was very angry, very angry. And the men were cursing and everything. Why the hell did you come here? Get out of here and all this. He was so rejected and felt so despair. Then one day I thought, buddy, I gotta do it. I said, son, I want to have you feel. I believe, and I'm looking at you and seeing the face of my God. He said, nobody wants me. I said, but he loves you. And we talked about Jesus. His whole life changed. His whole life changed. Then we had another young guy who was 22 years old dying. His father was supposed to become a Catholic in Washington. And around 11 o'clock at night, they called Rabbi Ashdover. So the Lord said he's died. He said, I want to say goodbye to my father. I said, oh, son, I said, give me his number, I'll call him. I called him and said, who are you? And I told him why I call, apologize the hour. Your son said, he's not my son. I said, he is your son, he's dying. He goes to communion every day, he prays a rosary, he's dying a holy death. He wants to say goodbye to you. He told me where to go and slam the phone down. I went back and the boy said, is my dad coming? I couldn't say he doesn't want you. I said, will you call me father? Could I be your dad just for the night, Jimmy? He said, oh, I understand, father. He died before the morning. After I buried him, I called the pastor of that parish, from the prominent parish, and I said, this is so much of your parish. He said, he goes to communion every day. He said, that's parishioner. I didn't say anything. I thought, what a hypocrite. And apparently, what happened in church, he never took me out the doors. He locked it up there, as we were told by some people. Leave your church today, apologies. Leave it in church, don't take anything out the doors. And that's what he would do to me. Let God be the judge of that. But you saw things there, like I had a paper, $300. I was a poor guy, I didn't have $300. I borrowed it. She wore three $100 bills, and I come and say goodbye to Teresa. Her daughter was dying. They had the women and the children the first floor, the nuns in the second, and then the top floor was for the men. And she came, she didn't leave me 10 minutes. She went to the hall and said, you want the ladies' room? She said, I'm out of here. I said, but Teresa, Doc, please don't go. She said, go to hell, give me my money. And off she went. Teresa died with her room. I saw things that said to me, why can Christians just turn their back and walk away from people like this? Mother's challenge of other ones, if you don't see, for example, until me, I'm losing my sight, the rest of the family, my grandparents were blind. My generation often was the people my age, but I got a super job out of it, apparently. But Mother said it'd be better to be blind here than here. So when she challenged me to say, Father, see with your heart, not just with your eyes. Listen with your heart, not just your ears. The first time she asked me to wash her liver, I didn't want to touch that guy. That boy, he was a mess. The blood, I'm not describing it. And then, he's given a blessing, you know. And then she said, Father, why are you frightened? Don't you recognize Jesus? He said, the least person you'll find me. Don't you see your God there, Jesus? And everything changed. Everything changed. You know, I was her director, you know, she was my director. But let me just tell something that maybe you've heard about. It's in several books, and unfortunately mentioned me every once in a while. But with this, my first visit got cut. One night we're in this big room. We're talking about how God allows us sometimes to experience an absence of His presence. We call it for you and I, we call it the light of privation, but God won't turn us into hide from you. The hours of weeks, then He's back again. The dark night, no sense of God in your life. As if heaven doesn't want to be there. Great things like St. Jude's in Avila, John the Cross, even St. Paul alludes to it, the Luftfahrer. These people all mentioned this. Well, that night, I didn't know about Mother's darkness, and we're in this big room for 1 hour, and we're in the Blessed Sacrament, set up on a table bound like this. And suddenly, a nun pulled on my elbow and handed me a piece of paper, which I had treasured. And all she writes is, "Father, please pray for me. Where is Jesus?" I didn't know what she meant. So it was over. So we're standing outside. Suddenly, the nun, Mother and I was chit-chatting. She said, "How can Mother do what she does if she doesn't feel God's presence? You know, I got my candle bar, God, and saved me." And Mother frowned and walked away. What she was going through was, as I noted that all these almost 40 years of friendship, God had driven her for over half a century any sense of what we call sense of a consolation. I told her a story when I was a young kid growing up in Virginia. I moved to Washington at age of 10 at D.C. And I said, you know, we didn't have a nickel, a depression had come and gone. And my brother, we got 25 cents and we would take the coal in the basket and put in the woodshed from the street. And it had central heating. And I begged and finally my mother said, "All right, try it. I'm going to plug nickel." And that night at supper, I said, "Mama, where's my quarter?" She gave me one and said, "I'm sorry, son. I thought you did it because you loved me. Ouch." You know, I told Mother that. Mother said, "That's what it's all about. People say, God, I'll do this for you. What am I getting out of it? I'll go to what I'm getting out of it. I'll surrender this. Give me my reward." We always say, "God, I'm going to do these things, but you must lift me up like an emotional thrill." But to be down and feel as if God is saying, doesn't exist, you live with one another's different. When Mother came here in 1994, she came as a special favor to me, she told me, because she had several heart attacks. She was dying in 2 years. And the nun said, "Oh, Mother cannot come." The mother called me, I don't know where she was, but she was telephoning me, honest. She said, "You're my special friend, you're my son, I'm coming." So we let him know, and we got hold of the Colosseum, the one that tore down. And 14,000 people showed up, which was a 2 days morning. And I heard the students sing. And then when it was over, we went back to the convent where I had Mass on Wednesday with the sisters. And after confession was over, that's between her and I and God, we were talking. I said, "Mother, God gave you a special gift. Some people do things because they get a reward out of it. If I do this, I get money. I get my candy bar, you know. I get the house I wanted. I will do this, what am I getting? But to give and feel nothing in return, that takes to heroic, blind love." I said, "Mother, God gave you a gift. God gave you his absence all this half a century. He removed his son that you're living on blind love. The greatest act of faith to do something out of love with no promise of any sense of reward here on earth." And she kept repeating that, tell me again and again. I talked to her before she died, when dying in Calcutta, and she said, "In my key to heaven, I love Jesus in the night." I remember testifying to this to the Vatican when they beatified Mother, and the things I could say without confession, of course. I love Jesus in the night. I find sometimes with Christians, like that poor dying boy's father, you know, go to church and sing your hymns and your prayers, but does it go beyond that? You don't transform and suddenly you see things differently. You see things not with the eyes, you see with your heart, you sense there is God's presence. Like one day in my second visit, I got there before she arrived home. She was in Germany and she sent word for me to meet her at the plane for some reason. So the nuns took her there in this little beat up truck. And we got to the airport. When she got off the plane, we greet each other. We were sitting on these little wooden seats, waiting for this boxes of clothes and medicine and food to get off the plane. And the beautiful woman came up. She was gorgeous, like a movie star. And her husband, apparently, was a pilot, rather tall for an Indian. And he was with her, his arm around her shoulder, and she was weeping. She knelt at another seat. And she dropped the veil, and it looked like pearls, the flesh, tumors, all around her throat, horrible tumors. And she was weeping. She said, I had little children, 4 year-old children. Oh, mother, help me. I remember mother put her hands like this beside her face, touching those horrible disfigurements, and said, I promise you that Jesus will cure you. The children need you. I promise you. Please do not fear. The woman smiled as she walked away. She kept looking back at mother, half smiling, half crying. The next time I was there, I said to her, what happened to that woman? She said, she woke up 2 days later and was all gone. I said, mother, what happened? She said, you don't discuss these things. Well, that same time with that woman, my last night that time, I was in a room that had these rusty fans, you know, in Calcutta. It's suddenly trouble with all electricity. You know, it was a walking, but I had a flashlight to get around. And I reached up in the door, and there was a rusty fan, curling, and it laid me over from here to here. Rip my arm. I'm not talking about blood, I'm not about gore. I said, so then I know what to do with the flashlight. I went outside and I saw some lights across the compound. It's a place for little babies, you know, with TB and different diseases, where I've given the nuns a retreat at that particular time. And we know the 2 nuns were there, they washed it and bandaged it. One said, oh, that's terrible. You can do nothing till morning. Well, I had to leave the next day. He came back to America by way of New Delhi, London, Baltimore, and finally hello back here. And I said, gee, what am I going to do? Well, mother came and they said, mother, there were red lions and it was terrible. And mother said, do not fear. There's a wooden table. She washed it, you know, that she could. It's all torn. And then she put a bandage around it, said a prayer, put it in a sling, and took it to the airport. Well, when I got to New Delhi, it was about like 1 o'clock in the morning, there was a priest there going home from India, and I said, would you watch my briefcase? I said, I've got to go to the bathroom. And I said, see what's happening? It's all blood on the bandage. God is my judge. I get to the bathroom. I said, this is going to be a mess. I drink the spring all the time, unwound it, all the blood. From here to here, not a scratch. Not even a mark, not even a line. I said, am I crazy? This thing is torn open. Well, of course, when I got home, I called my mother, we don't discuss these things. So, I've got a lot of things to discuss, as I believe you and me. But miracles. But see, Rome doesn't accept these miracles. So, I mean, here, you've got to be in heaven to perform a miracle for Rome. You're dead, then you prove you can do it from heaven. But for me, that was a miracle. I mean, from your elbow to here, to the rib open, and suddenly nothing. Pure skin, and yet blood all over the bandages. I can explain those things. But the biggest thing to do with this, she actually believed that she got up in the morning, God woke up with her. She said, if you really believe in Jesus, you're really a disciple, and you nourish your life with the Eucharist and prayer, and humble confession, if you take your faith seriously, God wakes up in you. When he's going to his death, Jesus says, the next time I come, he didn't mention Bethlehem. He said, I will come in you. I will live in you. She takes him seriously. She said, I believe. But oh my eyes, God looks through my eyes in the world. He sees his children suffering through my eyes. When I speak words of hope and joy and peace, I echo his voice. When I wash lepers, my hands are his hands washing his wounds. In this poem, she actually believed that God possessed her. You're talking about possessed by the devil. I have a known case years ago that they discussed those things. But she believed that God possessed us. That actually God walks the earth in us. And that he'll move us. I remember one time I actually told you that I was in the parish. And I woke up around 2 in the morning night with a guy named Thomas Shields, had leukemia. He was in the NIH. Institute and the professor, and I was in the Coma Park, Maryland, and strong rain like mad, and I said, God, about it in. But for some reason, I got up, I got dressed, went to the car, got soaking wet, and walked down the parking lot, went to the hospital, and when I got there, I thought, I'm crazy, nobody sent for me. There's no nursing, no doctor, no guards to stop me. I just walked up to Central, I've been there before. And I saw the light on his door, and I pushed it gently, and he had the mask in those days, took it off. He had a rose in his right hand, he said, Mr. Ned said, I was praying that you would come and that you'd talk to me, Father. I said, well, I was talking about 2 o'clock in the morning storms at the time, so I'm laughing. When the sun came up, I said, time to have first mass. I'll be back. He said, you don't have to come back, Father. It's okay now. You know it's okay. You know the mass and die. I can't explain those things that happen so frequently. God does. I told the mother. The mother said, why are you so surprised? God moves you. God will have you say things in some big places you never planned to go. If he's in here, he'll always be out there. If not, you will find like a disease inside of you. She said the worst disease is not leprosy. It's not AIDS. It's not cancer. The worst disease is the absence of God in us. That's the worst disease of all. I remember telling some people that recently, I said, that's what keeps me in business. But the whole thing is, do you actually believe that when you woke up this morning, God woke up on you? You looked maybe at your roommate and said, good morning. You said to someone else who's going to be discouraged, don't rush to work out fine. Or maybe one of your lost parents said, this out of here, you're not alone. Because all, if you actually believe that he acts in us, he puts us where he needs to be. Because he continues his mission. I remember my coming back from a retreat, and my pastor said, where are you going? You've been in prayer all day. I'm going to the church. Why have you been in prayer all day? I said, I don't know, but I feel like I go to the church. Now, all that day I've been depressed. I'm not the depressed type of person, you know. But I felt so discouraged. I don't know what happened. I was scared about it. I thought, gee, what's happened to me? I'm not like this. Go to the church, and suddenly I felt the pew rock. I looked at the man who knelt beside me and said, did you hear my confession, Father? Well, after about an hour or two, I came out, and he was waiting for me. And he said, strange, Father. He said, you know what happened now in my life? I felt terrible depression. When I passed your church that day, driving down to the downtown to watch him work, I suddenly felt peace and happiness. And I said, it's been written one day, I said, God, if there's a priest in that church and I go by, which will be like 3:30, 4 o'clock, I promise I won't start again. That's my walking God, and here you are. I don't intend to go anywhere. I can tell so many stories like that. It seems artificial, but it's not. It's true. Mother said it's true. And it's not for your elation. There are many times you feel like bankrupt, so to speak, in the sense of, you know, being lifted up. But you do it out of love. Like my parents. I remember when I was 10, and I had watched my parents' peritonitis, and they said, you're